Good evening, everyone. Tonight, we're continuing our look at the general study on the restoration movement, and specifically, we're dealing with the premise that the founding of America was a catalyst for the restoration movement. And one of the side issues that comes up quite often when we start talking about the founding of America is the issue of separation of church and state. So we're going to be looking at this issue tonight, this issue of separation of church and state. I want to tell you that many of the pictures and slides that we're going to be doing tonight, or showing tonight, come from a video called The Silencing of God, and I have that video. It's about a four-hour presentation with lots of pictures and everything, and also have two companion books that go with it. If you tonight find yourself wanting to know more than what we're covering in this material, I would encourage you to borrow these from me and take them home and watch them at your leisure. But what we're going to look at tonight is the fact that American culture has for 185 years been very friendly toward Christianity. In fact, America was founded on the principle that it wanted to be a Christian nation. Now, when they used that terminology, they were not talking about everyone in the nation being saved, but everyone in the nation following principles that were contained in the New Testament and which were advocated by Jesus Christ and his apostles. But for the last 50 years or so, the forces of humanism, atheism, evolution, liberalism, pluralism, and political correctness have been very aggressive in their assault on the Christian religion. And so what has happened is that America's religious, moral, and spiritual foundation is actually disintegrating, and we're seeing the results of all of that. We also are seeing that every effort is being made to absolutely eradicate all public references to God and Christianity. You're seeing a great many efforts made to take God out of everything. And monuments, from monuments down to phrases that are in our Constitution, phrases that are on our money, phrases that are uttered in our Pledge of Allegiance, things that are even found in our national anthem. A lot of effort is being made to eradicate these, to erase these things. And so what we're seeing is that a lot of Christianity and Jewish thought, the culture that we have, a lot of it is being smashed by the courts. And what they're using for this effort is, in reality, what they call the separation of church and state. Liberal historians and judges are literally rewriting our history and rewriting our laws. And we're being told that public expressions of Christianity should not be allowed, lest we offend those who do not share our beliefs. To practice the Christian religion is deemed insensitive to others around us. And yet, this is held specifically as something directed toward Christianity. For instance, one of the things that has happened in our culture is that it is no longer possible to say utter a prayer in a school setting. If you direct the prayer to Jesus or the Heavenly Father. And yet, at the same time, in many school districts across the United States, special accommodations are made for Muslim students to be able to have someone lead a public a call and assembly to prayer to Allah. And yet they don't see any dichotomy. They don't see any problem with all of that. So we have been told that the Constitution enjoins separation of church and state. We've been told that the founding fathers desired acceptance of all religion. We've been told that the founding fathers were deists, not Christians. We've also been told that the founding fathers opposed any public expression of the Christian religion in government or in school. That's what we've been told. And this is actually, in many ways, as the gentleman who did video that I have, this is kind of a conspiracy. I mean, it's not kind of, it is a conspiracy. It parades itself under the guise that the founding fathers advocated a separation of church and state, meaning that all references to God, and especially the Christian religion, should not be permitted in any public setting that is in any way associated with government, the community, or a public school. But as this unknown author said, it's easier to believe a lie that one has heard 1,000 times than to believe a fact that no one has heard before. The phrase separation of church and state is not even found in the Constitution. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to look at the fact that Thomas Jefferson here is seen as the one who advocated this pressing away, this split between church and state, and that he's the one who pushed for the amendment that backs this up. And we're going to see that really it's not true at all. For instance, William Rehnquist, the U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice, who was the 16th Supreme Court Justice, called the phrase a misleading metaphor. And he was a 16th Chief Justice nominated by Ronald Reagan, who served from September of 1986 to September of 2005. He wrote in a 1985 opinion that he believed the separation of church and state clause provided for in the Constitution applied only to the government showing preference for one religion over another. In June 2005, Rehnquist wrote the plurality opinion upholding the constitutionality of a display of the Ten Commandments at the Texas State Capitol in Austin. By the way, you may hear about this when the election season comes, because Governor Perry actually filed a lawsuit trying to, on the surface, force the Ten Commandments out of the state capitol in Austin. That's what you'll hear. But in reality, he filed the lawsuit so that it would be forced to go to the Supreme Court, so that it would make this kind of ruling, so that it would end up staying there. And in fact, it's still there in the state capitol in Texas. But Rehnquist said, our cases, Janus-like, point in two directions. Janusism is a Greek figure that looks in two directions at the same time, points in two directions in applying the Establishment Clause. One face looks toward the strong role played by religion and religious traditions throughout our nation's history. The other face looks toward the principle that governmental intervention in religious matters can itself endanger religious freedom. And he's very correct in that. In fact, as Rehnquist also said, the greatest injury of the wall notion is its mischievous diversion of judges from the actual intentions of the drafters of the Bill of Rights. The wall of separation between church and state is a metaphor based on bad history, a metaphor which has proved useless as a guide to judging. It should be frankly and explicitly abandoned, he suggested. He also said, it is impossible to build sound constitutional doctrine upon a mistaken understanding of constitutional history. The Establishment Clause has been expressly freighted with Jefferson's misleading metaphor for nearly 40 years. There is simply no historical foundation for the proposition that the framers intended to build a wall of separation between church and state. The recent court decisions are in no way based on either the language or the intent of the framers. This is one of the chief justices of the Supreme Court until 2005. So is it true that the founding fathers and the Constitution intended for Christianity to be kept out of the public sector? Does separation of church and state mean, one, keep all references to God, Jesus Christ, and the Bible out of public life, or does it mean, stop the government from interfering with the free exercise of the Christian religion? Which of these two positions is the actual purpose of the first Bill of Rights Amendment? So we're going to do some digging.
And we're going to do it because I think we've been following in the footsteps of Adolf Hitler. Hitler said, "By means of shrewd lies unremittingly repeated, it is possible to make people believe that heaven is hell and hell heaven. The greater the lie, the more readily it will be believed." And I think that is happening in our world today. So, we're going to do some checking of facts, okay? We're going to see what the truth about separation of church and state really is. And one of the things we're going to be looking at is specifically the Bill of Rights that's found in our Constitution. The First Amendment reads, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." That's the First Amendment. Thomas Jefferson, who is the one that we are told came up with the notion of separation of church and state, was not one of the 90 men who worked on framing our Bill of Rights and framing specifically the First Amendment. And during those debates, he was not one of the 90 framers ever mentioned the phrase separation of church and state. It seems logical that if this had been the intent of the First Amendment, as is so frequently asserted, then at least one of those 90 who framed the First Amendment would have mentioned that phrase, but none did. That comes from the Congressional Records from June 7th to September 25th, 1789. A look at those finds no record of him mentioning that phrase whatsoever. Jefferson's concept of separation of church and state, the one that the courts use, first became a part of jurisprudence or the court of law in a court case in 1878. In that case, the court examined the history of religious liberty in the United States, determining that while the Constitution guarantees religious freedom, the word religion was not defined in the Constitution. And so the court said we have to go elsewhere to ascertain what it means when we read the word religion. And nowhere more appropriately, the court said, we think, than to the history of the times in the midst of which the provision was adopted. So they go on and say, the court found that the leaders in advocating and formulating the constitutional guarantees of religious liberty were, in their opinion, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. I agree with James Madison. I don't agree with Thomas Jefferson. Quoting the separation paragraph from Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist Association, the court concluded that coming as this does from an acknowledged leader of the advocates of the measure, it may be accepted almost as an authoritative declaration of the scope and effect of the amendment thus secured. That's what the court said in 1878. Would you like to see what the actual letters say? This is a letter written to President Jefferson. This is written from the Danbury Baptist Association. It is written on the occasion of their being worried about certain things. And they write to the president and they say, by the way, Jefferson was our third president. Madison turns out to be our fourth president. We'll see what happens there in a minute. But they write to Jefferson and they say, "Our sentiments are uniformly on the side of religious liberty. That religion is at all times and places a matter between God and individuals. That no man ought to suffer in name, person, or effects on account of his religious opinions. And that the legitimate power of civil government extends no further than to punish the man who works ill to his neighbor. But, sir, our constitution of government is not specific. Therefore, what religious privileges we enjoy as favors granted, not as inalienable rights." Now, they put the word inalienable there when they probably meant unalienable. We'll talk about that in a moment and about why. So they're worried that the government might take away those things which contribute to the free exercise of religious liberty. Okay? This letter was written on October 7th, 1801, from the Danbury Baptist Association to Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson responded, "Gentlemen,
the affectionate sentiments and appropriation which you are so good as to express towards me on behalf of the Danbury Baptist Association give me the highest satisfaction. Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legislative powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should, and he quotes, make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. So he quotes the First Amendment, and he talks about the wall of separation. The next paragraph reads, adhering to this expression of the supreme will of the nation in behalf of the rights of conscience, I shall see with sincere satisfaction the progress of those sentiments which tend to restore to man all his natural rights, convinced he has no natural right in opposition to his social duties. I reciprocate your kind prayers for the protection and blessing of the common Father and Creator of man, and tender you for yourselves and your religious association assurances of my high respect and esteem. When you take it in the context of the two letters, Jefferson was actually saying that this First Amendment had been enacted only to prevent the federal establishment of a national denomination. You see, the Danbury Baptist Association had heard that there was a group who was lobbying Congress for the privilege of becoming the national religion of America. And they didn't want that to happen. They didn't want it to happen because then that would take away, it means that everybody who was a citizen of America, if he was going to be a good citizen, had to be a member of this religious affiliation, which was like it was happening in England. Everybody in England, which is the country we fought the war of independence against, had, if they were to be good citizens of England, had to be a member of the Anglican Church, of which the king was also head. And therefore, he was forcing everyone to become a member, whether they wanted to or not, if they wanted to be a good citizen of his country. And Jefferson says, no, there is a wall there. That's what this is, to prevent a national religion from being established. That's what he meant. It was a one-way permeable membrane. Now, a permeable membrane that is one way is like a one-way mirror. You can, when you look at it from one direction, all you see is a reflection of yourself because the light just bounces off. If you're on the other side of the one-way mirror, you can see through. The idea was government cannot interfere with religion. Religion should influence government. That was the intent, and I can prove it. Jefferson, in his letter to Benjamin Rush, said that this wall was the will of the American people that their new government not meddle in their religious freedoms by enacting a state denomination as the King of England had done. Jefferson committed himself as president to pursuing that purpose of the First Amendment, preventing the establishment of a particular form of Christianity by the Episcopals, Congregationalists, or any other denomination. This comes from Jefferson Writings, Volume 3, page 441, to Benjamin Rush. So the statement about wall of separation between church and state was made in a letter. And it was made in a letter assuring them that there would be no national established religion. Now, we have progressively used this affirmation of the First Amendment to the Constitution by Jefferson to create a lie that America stands for freedom from religion rather than freedom of religion. And there's a big difference, and that's exactly what the lie is. This lie effectively removes God from the public domain with very staggering consequences. George Washington, in his farewell address on September 17, 1796, said, "Let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion.
Reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle. He was prophetic. He was absolutely prophetic. He said, we may come to a point where we think that we can have a moral country divorced from religious teachings found in the Bible, and he says you can't do it. President Harry Truman said, the fundamental basis of this nation's law was given to Moses on the Mount. The fundamental basis of our Bill of Rights comes from the teaching we get from Exodus and Matthew, from Isaiah and Paul. I don't think we emphasize that enough these days. If we don't have the proper fundamental moral background, we will finally end up with a totalitarian government which does not believe in the right for anybody except the state. That was President Truman. And I think he's also prophetic as well. You see, we need to understand that there is a direct link between the Declaration of Independence, signed on July 4th, 1776, and the United States Constitution, signed in September 17th, 1787, and the Bill of Rights, which finally was finished December 15th, 1791. All three documents are absolutely connected. And especially the original Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence. Because the Bill of Rights was intended to deal with something that was mentioned in our Declaration of Independence. Our Declaration of Independence, you might remember, has several references to God in it. To nature's God, to the fact that we have rights granted to us, endowed to us by our Creator. It mentions the supreme judge of the world. It mentions divine providence, with the providence being capitalized, talking about the active working of God in man's history. With the 56 framers of the Declaration of Independence acknowledge the God of the Bible. And this Declaration of Independence has this statement made in the second paragraph. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, you might have heard that it is inalienable rights instead of unalienable rights. Because Jefferson's original draft of this phrase had inalienable instead of unalienable. Members of the Declaration Committee, including Benjamin Franklin and John Adams, argued that the word inalienable needed to be changed to unalienable. And the reason was because unalienable means incapable of being alienated, that is, sold or transferred. That's Black's Law Dictionary, which was the standard for law in their day. You can't, in other words, you cannot surrender, sell, or transfer unalienable rights. They are a gift from the Creator to the individual and cannot under any circumstances be surrendered or taken. All individuals have unalienable rights. And some of those rights are listed in the Declaration, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Others are not listed because it can be too long. But one of the implied rights is the right to the free exercise of your conscience to worship God, your Creator, in the manner that is best suiting your conscience. They base this in part on Romans 2, 14 and 15, which talk about how the law of God is written on the hearts, in the hearts of men and our conscience. Inalienable, which was what Jefferson had originally, means rights which are not capable of being surrendered or transferred without consent of the one possessing such rights. So that means you can give these rights up to government if you consent to do it. Unalienable says you can't give them up no matter what. So that's why they argued for it. You can surrender, sell, or transfer inalienable rights if you consent, either actually or constructively. Inalienable rights are not inherent in man and can be alienated by government. Persons have inalienable rights, and most state constitutions recognize only inalienable rights. But U.S. Supreme Court, 1875, said the very highest duty of the states when they entered into the Union under the Constitution was to protect all persons within their boundaries in the enjoyment of these unalienable rights with which they were endowed by their Creator. So the U.S. Supreme Court in 1875 said this is the purpose of the Constitution. The purpose of the Constitution was to protect all unalienable rights which man is endowed with by their Creator. The first 10 amendments, again another U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 1956, says the first 10 amendments of the Constitution, adopted as they were soon after the adoption of the Constitution, are in the nature of a Bill of Rights and were adopted in order to quiet the apprehension of many that without some such declaration of rights, the government would assume and might be held to possess the power to trespass upon those rights of persons and property which by Declaration of Independence were affirmed to be unalienable rights. So there's your key word, unalienable rights. Rights given by God to His creation. And so we begin to find out that their thinking was highly influenced by the Bible. There was a study done called The Origins of American Constitutionalism. This study was to identify the sources of the founders' political ideas. And their sources came from a lot of things, but notice this. The founders quoted the Bible more than any other source. Historians are discovering, and this appeared in Newsweek December 27, 1982, are discovering that the Bible, perhaps even more than the Constitution, is our founding document. The U.S. Constitution avoided giving specific directives regarding Christianity, yet the Christian religion is implicitly embedded there. And specifically, when you get to the Bill of Rights, our fourth president was the author of the Bill of Rights, James Madison. And the Bill of Rights, that's one copy of it, basically is a collection of 10 rights, including the right to freedom of speech, religion, press, assembly, and petition, the right to bear arms, the right to dealing with quartering of soldiers, arrests and searches, rights of persons accused of crimes, rights of persons on trial for crimes, jury trials, bail and punishments, rights that are kept by the people, in other words, things that aren't listed, and powers kept by the states for the people. So there's a lot there. But James Madison, the principal drafter of the Bill of Rights, I remember it didn't pass until 1791. In a debate in 1789, this is 2 years before it passes, in a debate in the House of Representatives regarding the first draft of the First Amendment, said, August 15, 1789, Mr. Peter Sylvester of New York had some doubts. He feared it, the First Amendment, might be thought to have a tendency to abolish religion altogether. Mr. Eldridge Gerry of Massachusetts said it would read better if it was that no religious doctrine shall be established by law. Mr. James Madison of Virginia said he apprehended the meaning of the words to be that Congress should not establish a religion and enforce the legal observation of it by law. The states seem to entertain an opinion that under the clause of the Constitution, it enabled them to make laws of such a nature as might establish a national religion. To prevent these effects, he presumed the amendment was intended. Mr. Madison thought if the word national was inserted before religion, it would satisfy the minds of honorable gentlemen. He thought if the word national was introduced, it would point the amendment directly to the object it was intended to prevent. So here in this discussion, found in the congressional record, House of Representatives, 1789, 2 years before it passes, they're talking about the purpose. The purpose is not to have the establishment of a national religion. Madison contended, because if religion be exempt from the authority of the society at large, because it's an unalienable right, Still less can it be subject to that of the legislative body. Later, in a letter to Edward Livingston, Madison further expanded, "We are teaching the world the great truth that governments do better without kings and nobles than with them. The merit will be doubled by the other lesson that religion flourishes in greater purity without than with the aid of government." So that's the intent. See, the attitude's further reflected in the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which was originally authored by Jefferson and used by Madison to write the First Amendment. Now, this is what Jefferson said. No man shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship, place, or ministry whatsoever, nor shall be enforced, restrained, molested, or burdened in his body or goods, nor shall otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions or belief, but that all men shall be free to profess and by argument to maintain their opinion in matters of religion, and that the same shall in no wise diminish, enlarge, or affect their civil capacities. So that was the thing that was argued for, or what the First Amendment was based upon, written by Jefferson. Again, the idea is very different from how the court have interpreted separation of church and state. But the idea is that you cannot have government affecting religion. Not religion affecting a government. The New Jersey Constitution of 1776, again, one of the things that was used in their discussion to come up with the First Amendment, wrote in their constitution, their state constitution, that there shall be no establishment of any one religious sect in this province in preference to another, and that no Protestant inhabitant of this colony shall be denied the enjoyment of any civil right merely on account of his religious principles, but that all persons professing a belief in the faith of any Protestant sect who shall demean themselves peaceably under the government, as hereby established, shall be capable of being elected into any office of profit or trust, or being a member of either branch of the legislature, and shall fully and freely enjoy every privilege and immunity enjoyed by others, their fellow subjects. Again, that's very different, isn't it? The first Congress deliberated about this and their understanding of the separation of church and state. And historian Philip Schaff observes, "The American separation of church and state rests upon respect for the church. The European anti-clerical separation rests on indifference and hatred of the church and of religion itself. The Constitution did not create a nation, nor its religion and institutions. It found them already existing and was framed for the purpose of protecting them under a republican form of government in a rule of the people, by the people, and for the people." By the way, does that phrase sound... if it sounds familiar to you, that phrase was coined and used by several people, but most famously by Abraham Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address. In 1789, from Madison's own writings, there was this statement. This is a quote, again, a quotation of the House of Representatives' record. Mr. Madison said he apprehended the meaning of the words to be that Congress should not establish a religion and enforce the legal observation of it by law, nor compel men to worship God in any manner contrary to their conscience. That's the intent of the First Amendment. Representative Samuel Livermore of New Hampshire proposed a language stating that Congress should make no laws touching religion or the rights of conscience, but they figured that the language was could actually be used to harm religious practice. In Amendment 9 of the U.S. Constitution, the framers recognized other rights, and they said the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people, because it has to do with unalienable rights. The Founding Fathers, when writing the laws that would shape our land, did not envision a state that influenced the religion of its people. That's what was happening in England, with the King of England creating the Church of England so that he could essentially get a divorce, since the Catholic Church wouldn't grant divorces. Henry VIII then made all of his citizens of his kingdom underneath his religious control as he appointed himself the head of the religion of England. That's the context for the Founding Fathers' declaration that there be some sort of separation. In 1808, Jefferson wrote another letter to the Virginia Baptists, and he would use the same theme. He says, "We have solved by fair experiment the great and interesting question whether freedom of religion is compatible with order in government and obedience to the laws. We've experienced the quiet as well as the comfort which results from leaving everyone to profess freely and openly those principles of religion which are the inductions of his own reason and the serious convictions of his own inquiries." So, Jefferson didn't advocate we remove everything. So the true meaning of the separation of church and state was meant to keep the church away from the influences of the state. And in the Supreme Court, they for years argued in that manner. For instance, in 1878, Reynolds versus United States, the intent of Jefferson's remarks was that the rightful purposes of civil government are for its officers to interfere when principles break out into overacts against peace and good order. In this is found the true distinction between what properly belongs to the church and what to the state. In other words, Romans chapter 13, government exists to punish evildoers. Church of the Holy Trinity versus the U.S., February 1892. The Supreme Court said, "These and many other matters which might be noticed add a volume of unofficial declarations to the mass of organic utterances that this is a Christian nation." And then they list 87 precedents in a 16-page document. So we have one man's private letter taken out of context. The earlier courts always viewed Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist Association for just what it was, a personal private letter to a specific group. There is probably no other instance in American history where words spoken by a single individual in a private letter, words clearly taken out of context, have become the sole authorization for a national policy. So this First Amendment, to remind you, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or permitting the free exercise thereof." All right? Establishment of religion. No one Protestant denomination singled out above another. No government interference with the free and public practice of the Christian religion. Not freedom from religion, but rather freedom for religion. The Christian religion. Fact is, the whole idea was that human happiness, political prosperity, and popular government rested on the two pillars of morality and religion. And if you removed religion, then morality would crumble, and so would everything else. So on what is America's liberty and freedom based? On what does America's freedom depend? Does our freedom rest upon the economy? No. A strong military? No. Healthcare? No. Morality? No. Hinduism? Well, yes, it does, but morality based on what? Morality based on Hinduism? No. Buddhism? No. Judaism? No. Islam? No. Atheism? No. But the Christian religion. And so, what we have in the separation of church and state clause is the idea that you and I should be able to use our minds, study our Bibles, look at the pages of the New Testament specifically, read about Jesus, and decide for ourselves how to worship God. That's why I say that it was a catalyst for the Restoration Movement. Because that level of freedom, of exercise of one's own mind, is something that had never been seen before, never been encouraged before by any kind of government. And now it's not being encouraged again. Our government has now gone the other way, and there's a lot of things that I could show you, and if there are enough people who are interested, I may do an additional lesson next Sunday in which I can show you, but our government
at the very beginning, and through about the first 170 years or so, saturated itself with symbols and references to God, and placed them where people could see them, and placed them in places where people would read them, on purpose, because they knew it benefited government. Now we're being told you can't have it. Fact is, if Sam here were to take a Bible and place it on her desk at her school, and she has a desk that does not have students going in and out, probably being a PE teacher, but place it on her desk at her school, she would be asked and told it's against the law, you must remove it, or face suspension or firing for having a Bible on her own personal Bible on her desk. That's not what the Constitution would have said. That's not really what the Constitution says at all. The Constitution says that you have the right to free exercise. We've had people who are graduating from high school and colleges who give valedictorian speeches, and in those valedictorian speeches want to mention God, and they've been told, no, you can't do it. In one case, just a couple of years ago, they pulled the microphone plug from a girl giving her commencement address because she was starting to mention God, and they said, no, you can't do that. It's against the law. It's not against the law. It's not against the law at all. Actually, the law is on her side, and the law is on your side and my side for the free exercise of our religion. The government has no authority over our expression of religion, according to the First Amendment of the United States. Unfortunately, history is being rewritten, and most of us are ignorant of what the Constitution actually says. Our God, I'm wearing a tie that has the great commandment, Matthew 22:37. The great commandment says we're supposed to love the Lord our God with all of our heart, with all of our soul, with all of our mind, and all of our strength. Our founding fathers took that idea of being able to use one's own mind and devote one's whole self to serving God in whatever manner that individuals' conscience led them to heart. We owe our founding fathers a great debt for what they enabled to come into being. And we should not stand idly by and let people be unaware of the direction our country is heading, because it will infringe upon our ability to serve our God just the way this passage of Scripture and Jesus command tells us to. So we need to be a people who proclaim God and proclaim liberty and proclaim it loudly and boldly and recognize that this is what our God wants us to do. This evening, if you're not a Christian, we want to encourage you to follow Jesus Christ tonight. And if there's anything that we can do, if there's for any individual, we want to encourage you to let us know by the end of the stand and sing.